There's a time and a place for filet of fish. But breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Joseph Sternberg, my colleague, is in London. But we're together in our imaginations, heading to Switzerland, to a village where I'm told there's not snow as usual this time of winter time in Davos. The gathering of eagles and media representatives and leaders and speeches and prospects for 2023. It's been catch-as-catch-can for the last 2 years of pandemic, but in person now there are exciting events or not, because the question in front of all of us is globalization returning to its healthy vigor before pandemic? And what does it mean that China is now reporting a contraction in some fashion? 3% growth is extremely low for my experience in China. Also, a shrinking population, the birth rate is less than the death rate. And the general question of trust in the Chinese business model, the business plan. The charm offensive of these last days by Chinese officials is hard to believe. At the same time, the question about China returning to business as usual seems far-fetched. So, Joe, I come to you immediately about Davos. Davos is said to be the centerpiece of globalized success in the early part of this century. What is it now, Joe? What does it mean? Is it old business? Is this like an alumni association remembering the good old days?
Well, I think at this point it's a little difficult to say what Davos is. I think that it is sort of an attempt for the great and good of the business world to get together and mingle with each other and do that sort of networking, and then also try to get proximity to the government officials who often regulate these industries or threaten to. I think that It has seemed for quite a long time that the main thing that gets accomplished there is a lot of the networking behind the scenes rather than any of the discussions or public panels or any of the rest of it that goes on. That being said, there has been some interesting news today where, the Chinese Vice Premier Liu He, who has attended on behalf of the Communist Party government in Beijing, is trying to use this occasion to throw open the door of China to more investment from the kind of companies who are at Davos. Again, it's sort of this interesting question of you can go there and you can give a speech, but ultimately what's going to matter a lot more than the speech is what you actually do on the ground once you've left.
We have the Wall Street Journal coverage, which includes ironic quotes. I read one. The mood here at Davos is somber, said Nick Stutter, CEO of Oliver Wyman Group Consultancy, who has attended meetings in Davos for years. Quote, at the same time, you've got a lot of people hoping that the U.S. and the U.K. environment, if it's recessionary, is either short or shallow. We're hoping, Joe, for a short and shallow recession. Now, I see none of that in the predictions by the banks and their economists. I see the CEOs all preparing for winter and preparing for recession ahead. So Davos is built on hope. I go along with that, but is that something we can look to for a policy change, or are they just going to bounce along? And if it's a recession, they'll say, we'll get over it. And if it's not a recession, they'll what, say prayers? In other words, what's the point here, Joe? I've always puzzled about Davos. Is it to validate what exists, or is it to make predictions of the future?
Oh, I think it's very much a validation exercise. I mean, if the Davos set really wanted to avert a European or American recession, what they would do over the next couple of days is repudiate all of the green energy stuff that the Davos crew has embraced with such enthusiasm over the years. I mean, one thing that would really kind of shock everyone's system would be if you had people coming out of Davos saying, you know what? We have concluded that in this economic environment right now, we cannot afford the folly of all of the green energy that we always virtue signal about it, these fora. But they're not going to do that. I think what they actually want is, you know, something closer to rent seeking, where they hope that if they can spout the right kind of virtue on either green issues or anything else, they can secure sufficient regulatory favor with the policymakers who are at Davos or who are watching it, you know, to try to help them out once they get back home. So this is not an exercise in recession prevention. At best, it is an exercise in damage mitigation.
Let's go to China, Joe. You were many years reporting in China out of Hong Kong. The conduct of Xi Jinping over these last months is unacceptable. He's at once a bully, and other times he's just not available. He's missing in action. We can recite the COVID zero policy a failure. We can certainly say the hospital system has collapsed. The anecdotes are horror. But at the same time, now this charm offensive, while the GDP is shrinking, while the population is shrinking, is that going to engender a new consideration of the People's Republic of China as a business partner? Is Europe, is America going to rethink putting its money at risk again in a culture that can change from one day open-handed to the next day it's got a gun out?
No, I'm not sure that you can see that kind of change now. And this is about to be a real shock to the Communist Party regime in Beijing, actually, because they have often made policy and conducted themselves as if they believed that they were pulling a bunch of levers that they could operate very precisely to achieve a given result. And what's interesting right now is that on so many fronts, the things seem to be spiraling out of Beijing's control now. So, for example, in terms of its economic relationship with the West, particularly the U.S. and Europe, we are in a situation now where I think that attitudes are really hardening in a lot of Western capitals for political reasons, to do with, you know, an emerging consensus that Beijing is not a trustworthy partner on the global stage. People are really annoyed with Xi Jinping for his friendship pledge with Vladimir Putin right before Putin engaged in the Ukraine invasion. You know, there is this understanding that China has never really lived up to some of the economic reforms, the market opening or liberalization or rule of law reform that it had promised foreign investors. There is a new awareness of an interest in human rights problems in a lot of Western capitals. And that is not something that Beijing is going to be able to change at the snap of a finger. In the same way that China is not going to be able to change its demographic decline easily. Because remember, back in 2016, Beijing reversed the one-child policy that had been in operation for many decades. And they seemed to hope that doing that would instantly lead to a surge in the birth rate. Instead, it has continued to decline, so that it turns out that after several decades of the coercive party-imposed one-child policy, now demographics in China is taking on a life of its own, and it's very difficult for the party to control that. It's this interesting question of how much Xi Jinping is a master of his own fate right now versus how much he is waiting for events himself to see what's going to become of China.
A story that we don't have the answer to, but I want to measure the mood in Europe or in London about Ukraine conflict. Russia and China are now involved in Ukraine conflict. Russia with an active military, a brutal military, and China pledging alliance, friendship, even a state visit by Xi Jinping. Has that become acceptable in Europe, that we're in a state of war, that it's normal for two adversaries to talk as if they're going to overrun our allies in some fashion, people we've allied ourselves with, the people of Kyiv? Is it normal in Europe to just conduct our affairs recovering from a pandemic caused, we don't know why, out of China, and a recession caused by, you fill in the blank? And we'll just carry on. And the new world includes this sort of pest, which is Russia.
Well, I think what's interesting about the situation is that on the one hand, the idea that a war could happen in Ukraine on European soil has become kind of normalized just because it's been going on for so long now. We're very nearly at the 1 year mark for this war. And that's nearly one year where Europe has been grappling with the energy crisis and the issue of Russia sanctions and the potential for a changing relationship with China as a result of this, a deterioration in that relationship diplomatically and economically. So on the one hand, Europe is getting used to living in this kind of world. I think the thing that has been a bit slower for them is to understand that actually they can change that now. It's not just a matter of getting used to it. It's a matter of understanding that you have some agency and that you can play a role in shaping the world around you. I think that Europe had, in a strange way, fallen out of the habit of thinking about things that way. They're starting to get into it. And one sign of that is all of a sudden in the past few weeks, you've had this big upsurge in pretty hard-hitting military aid for Ukraine. And that is happening because at the same time that people are getting used to the notion that this war is happening, they're also starting to think that, well, hang on a sec, maybe Ukraine can actually win it, and maybe we can help Ukraine win it. And maybe by leaning on the scales a bit, by sending this military aid, that can reshape events in ways that would be good for us in Western Europe, too. So I think that's going to be the next realization that's going to have to happen here as Europe gets used to living in this less stable, less energy secure world. They're going to start understanding that actually they can affect what's going on around them to a certain extent.
I mentioned two ministers of the Sunak government. That would be Ben Wallace, Minister of Defense, and James Cleverly, Foreign Minister, have both been vigorous and robust speakers in defense of Ukraine and in opposition to Russia. James Cleverly is traveling in Washington saying he wants Washington to go further and faster. Ben Wallace has been adamant that the main battle tank Challenger 2 is headed to Ukraine, and so is a lot more aid. We're going to turn, however, to life in London next, because the NHS is a mystery unless you've participated in its origins and its evolution since the end of the Second War. Right now, it looks to be in a crisis. Is it routine? I don't know. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.